for your admission. The Dallas Counselors Forum has been active for over 45 years or so. We have all kinds of talks, not only on philosophy, of course, ethics being one, but science, religion, ethics, politics. Even we had the court laureate of Oklahoma. Two weeks from now, we have Fred Grinnell from UT Southwestern, a biochemist who also is head of the medical ethics department there. And he's going to talk about how taking advantage of opportunities that serendipity creates in scientific research. Then we have Dr. Lieberman from SMU, who will speak about the Confederate monuments. Then Clint Eubanks, software developer, will talk about the response for emerging threats to democracy. That's very timely. And then Randall McKellar will talk about the conflict paradox. We'll examine our human behavioral matrix of the tension between our sense of community and the need for conflict. Tonight, let's see, what else do I have to say? Pay your bill? Yeah. Oh, yes, your bill. I don't know if they included the
yes, they have.
They've included the gratuity at this time, so if you feel very generous, you may add it. But just make sure you pay your bill. Don't leave it to us because we have a limited budget. Anyway, tonight we have with us. I have to apologize for our speaker that was scheduled, Dr. Mears, John Mears, from SMU's history department, who is over 80 and. His wife said, "No, I don't want you to go out to a public place and give a talk, especially if they're eating." And anyway, so we are very fortunate to have our eminent president step into his shoes and speak to us tonight. So Rob Olson, who was born in Omaha, Nebraska.
Go Big Red.
You like porn? Graduated from SMU with a degree in philosophy and in economics. Is an author and research analyst for Risk Management Institute Group and a think tank and a publishing company. He earned his BA cum laude and serves the CPCU. Tell me what that stands for.
Charter Property Casualty Underwriter.
Okay, Property Casualty Underwriter. Society of it, and it has been the president of the Dallas chapter. He also serves as an adjunct professor at UTD, where he teaches risk management classes. He's also active in, of course, philosophy circles, and you also go to the Dallas prison, is that right, and have classes there?
Jail.
In the jail, the Dallas jail, the county jail. So, we are very fortunate and to have Rob to step in tonight, and we thank you very much. Without further ado, Rob Olson.
David, you're on now.
Fine. Can everybody hear me okay?
He's
up pretty high on my tie. You know these ties are good for something.
Well, you're right.
Is that any better? Yeah. Now they're in the back. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
A little bit more?
Please.
A little bit more?
Oh, we're getting feedback.
Okay, a little feedback. Let's see. So David Drun, how do I, guys, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
I'll try to speak up. Okay, great. Thank you. Well, thanks everyone for coming out. We were afraid that we were going to have, like, the board speaking to the board with all the fears about the coronavirus, but, you know, all viruses eventually go away or become mitigated and lose their potency at some point, so...
Is it on? Is it green? There, I'll turn.
You're good.
Wait, it's red. Okay, we'll put that back right there. Is it
on? Oh. Yeah, you're good. Okay, so when we lost our regular speaker, we thought, well, who are we going to get? And actually, I had given this talk to a risk management group a couple weeks ago, so it's still kind of fresh in my mind. And risk management insurance, there's a lot to do with ethics, and so there's ethics training that has to occur, and seeking and all that, so it worked out really well. I took a few insurance examples out, but I have examples about crime and racism and several things that I hope you'll find interesting. I really got into the happiness talk, which I do at the jail, after suffering a couple of really bad bouts with depression. And suicide ideation, and so when I got a little bit better, it's like I started getting really fascinated with what is this thing called happiness, and what does it mean, and what are some of the greatest thinkers in our civilization, in prior civilizations, what have they written about happiness, and then tying that into some of the cognitive scientists and researchers and their theories on that. And so then I thought, well, now maybe I can juxtapose happiness with ethics and tie the two together, which I really hadn't heard much before. So that's what I did. So this is my second time on this presentation. That's what the class is.
Come on.
So as a adjunct professor, I always have learning objectives. It just stays, it's ingrained in my DNA. So these are what we're going to cover. We're going to talk about the historical beginnings of the concept of ethics, and appreciate the relationship of ethics, happiness, and leading a fulfilled life, or as Aristotle talks about, living a good life. Grasp how ethical decisions are sometimes fraught with error, ambiguity, complexity, things like ethical fading, which I've been reading a lot about ethical fading, which is really a fascinating concept. And also wrongology, W-R-O-N-G-O-L-O-G-Y, wrongology. I've never heard of it before. Has anybody heard of wrongology? Well, it's a discipline, I guess. It's a growing discipline. And then discuss some real-life ethical dilemmas. So Socrates is considered the grandfather or the father of philosophy. The pre-Socratics often focused on, you know, what are the elements of the earth? You know, what's the earth made of? And there's fire, and there's air, and there's, you know, there's land and water. But the genius of Socrates and his student Plato was a focus on the human being and our psychological makeup and what drives us and what promotes us and such. And so I often really appreciate the fact that he didn't have like a list of things that he was going to teach his students. Basically, he just asked questions. And the focus was, challenge your assumptions. What do you mean by this word? What do you mean by that word? And dig deep into these issues to learn and get insights into the human condition. So consider the following philosophy, argued that the unexamined life is not worth living. And so basically, his whole premise was dig deep. Okay? And so when Plato wrote about Socrates, and we're not exactly sure how much of this is Plato and how much of this is Socrates. We were talking about this the other day, David, at the restaurant, about, you know, how much of Socrates, Plato, and all that. But he was really one of the first to explore ethics and virtuous living. But the philosopher who really dug deeply into the whole happiness issue was Aristotle. So you have Socrates, and his student was Plato, and Plato's student was Aristotle. So the way to remember it is spa, like you go to the spa, Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, because they were one generation apart. So he talked about using your full powers, emotional, intellectual, physical, all of these interpersonal skills along lines of excellence. Okay? So he was really positive that we need to strive for this ideal person. That should be our goal. And so, you know, now the Greeks were all about physical fitness and the origination of the Olympics and all that, and Aristotle was a big proponent of this really balanced life, which included physical fitness, good communication skills, intellectual skills. So in the Nicomachean Ethics, he argued that happiness consists of achieving through one's whole life all the things, health, wealth, virtue, knowledge, friends, that leads to perfection and enrichment of human life. Okay. And he basically said that it's rare. Living a happy life is a real rare thing. It's sort of in the realm of the gods. You know, the Aristocrats often said, well, you know, it's only the gods that can decide. You know, it's fate and the gods that will decide things. But Aristotle was one of the first that basically, you can carve your own happiness. You can develop your own ways of living your life, unlike the pre-Socratics, where it's not necessarily left up to the gods, where it's not necessarily left up to fate or luck. And so he says that ethics was an integral part of the happy and virtuous life. So he really was the first to tie in ethics and happiness together. And we're going to talk about some philosophers that didn't quite see it that way. So, he said that happiness is different from pleasure. Happiness is different from momentary pleasure. In other words, like a child could never be happy. Okay? Why would that be the case? That Aristotle said a child could never be happy. Why would that be the case? Anybody want to take a guess?
They live in the moment.
They live in the moment, but also...
They haven't lived long enough.
That's right. They haven't lived long enough to know whether they've had that happy. They haven't lived a complete life.
And they don't have enough agency.
Yes, they don't have enough agency. They have limited control. And so a way to think about it is like if you go to a football game and you're going to go get popcorn at halftime. And so this is a great game, isn't it? It's like, well, you don't really know. Maybe the second half is going to be a slaughter or all sorts of injuries. You don't know until the game is nearly completed whether it's a good game or not. And so that's how Aristotle looked at that. A happy life is a complete life. And he talked about to achieve this, we need to act morally and we need to place the interests of others ahead of our own. And this phrase here is, let's see if I have a hard time with this.
This way.
Arrow.
This way. This is the wrong one. Do it toward the machine.
The arrow is on the
front. The arrow seems to be doing that.
On the front. Push the front down. I don't know what's going on with that.
Now it's frozen on. Hmm. You want to back it up? What there?
Oh, sure,
maybe
what?
My water's
maybe that's a problem. I don't know. It shouldn't be. It should be worked out.
Aristotle said that happiness is the highest good and it's rare. A complete happy life is rare. And the pursuit of happiness is a worthwhile goal, but it's a goal that people need to act morally. They need to act as moral agents. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. So ethos is the Greek word for character, okay? And ethical behavior is the pathway for achieving this happiness and contentment. And so what Aristotle argued is that, and this you'll find some of this in Buddhism philosophy as well, is sort of the doctrine of the mean, okay? Living life in the middle, okay? So rather than being extremely stingy or being wasted with your money, be generous. And try to live life right down the middle. And so avoid the extremes in your life, and that's one of the first steps for achieving a happy life. But He also said the right course of action is very circumstantial, okay, as far as moral behavior, ethical behavior. It's like there's not like a fine line or a bright line that says this is ethical and this is not ethical. Okay, it's much more complicated. And so Aristotle was one of the first to say it's real situational. Ethical conduct is quite situational, circumstantial. So if you go and hear an ethics talk and it's presented as if it's black and white, then I think the speaker might be missing the boat, because we're going to get into some of these gray areas in just a minute. But Aristotle said that high ethics, this is a skill that you develop in time. Okay, so it's just like children. I'm not going to be ordered to develop this skill of ethical behavior. Children tend to be very selfish about their toys and stuff. But it's like learning a musical instrument. So Immanuel Kant and the categorical imperative, he more or less divorced happiness from ethical training. So in Nicomachean Ethics, Aristotle, he tied the two closely together, and Kant really challenged that precept. This is a Prussian-German philosopher of the Age of Enlightenment, and a major, major figure in modern philosophy. And he's very difficult to read. Has anybody ever tried to read Kant? David has, yeah. We've got some philosophers. You read it. How did that go?
Very tough.
Very tough, yes. But he's a central figure. He's written on so many different aspects. And a very, very seminal, brilliant thinker. But he said that our duty is not to ourselves. Our duty is to the overall health of our society.
Amen.
And so he said sometimes that, you know, taking those types of moral imperatives, those that duty to act, that's stripped away from your own personal happiness. Okay. And so he didn't draw the direct correlation between moral behavior and ethics that happens. Okay. More on that in just a second. But the supreme principle of ethics and morality revolves around the categorical imperative. Okay. Now let's talk about the categorical. So basically he's saying, act according to the maxim whereby you can, at the same time, will that it should become universal law. This is the concept of universality. And the pretext there is that there are universal truths. There are absolute truths. Now, Kant didn't go into a lot of detail on these types of absolute truths, and a lot of philosophers would disagree with the whole concept of there being absolute truth. But basically he said, you know, if you were to steal, okay, then, okay, so now I need to take that act of stealing and apply it to the universe. Everybody steals, okay? So what happens to property rights? The property rights go away, right? You don't have any property rights. You can't buy land anymore. You know, everyone's going to steal everyone else's property, and so the whole idea of property laws and property rights is a mystery, okay? Another one would be if you lie. Okay, so you're lying. Now you may basically say, okay, everyone's going to lie now. And then what does that do for the whole concept of truth and language and all that? It's like you can't trust the language anymore. You can't trust what someone's saying anymore. And so that'll be another example of the categorical imperative. Or if, you know, you borrow money from someone and you never paid them back, okay, then no one would loan anyone else money, because once again, now you have property rights that have gone askew. And that's one of the problems of, like, some of the countries in Africa. They don't have any property rights. They don't have the rule of law. And so you have so much poverty in so many of those countries. So mark of unethical behavior in Kant's mind is one makes an exception for oneself. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we tend to do with ethical failing. When we get into these ethical dilemmas, we often justify it by, you know, well, these are extenuating circumstances, and we sometimes make exceptions for ourselves. And in that situation, that scenario, then it all falls apart, according to Kant. So he says that ethics is initially divorced from happiness, and pleasure is not always good. And he really challenged this whole concept that we can know what will bring us happiness. Okay, so happiness exists as sort of this ethereal
idealistic concept out there. But that's very, very different than actually experiencing. So we're not good, according to Kant and many others, we're not good at really knowing what will bring us happiness. We think, well, if we win the lottery, or if we get this high-paying and high-pressure job, then that's going to give us happiness. And Alan Watts, a Buddhist philosopher, he always talks about getting something. And then you get to the corner, and then you have these unceasing desires for more stuff, and so you run around to the next corner, and you get some more stuff, and that you're always just chasing more and more things. And so Kant really challenged that. And so he was basically saying, we don't really know what's going to make us happy. If we knew what was going to make us happy, we would be omniscient. But we're not. I'm sad to say, we're not omniscient. And so what the interesting thing about Kant is that he links morality with becoming worthy of happiness. So if you live according to duty, okay, he always talks about act for your duty to society, that if you live according to your duty and you follow the categorical imperative, then you become a human being that's worthy of happiness. Okay? You're satisfied with yourself, you're near the end of your life, and you're thinking, this is the end result, and now, after all this time, I'm worthy of happiness. The Kant argued that if you go chasing happiness, that's not the best way to live ethical and moral life, because you're focused on these momentary pleasures. The momentary pleasures, and as Aristotle clearly pointed out, momentary pleasure is very different from happiness. I mean, just think about when we were studying for finals in college, and friends wanted to go out drinking and playing pool and partying, and yet we know, most of us did, we know that, no, I have to stay in my apartment or the dorm, and I have to study, because I'm thinking long term, right? And I'm not thinking momentary pleasures, right? And so, reading about Kant's take on this is very fascinating to me, is that You don't start out seeking happiness. You focus on your duty to society, to the overall health of society, and then hopefully happiness will ensue because you'll become a person worthy of happiness. And I thought that was quite striking. John Stuart Mill and happiness is an English philosopher, and he developed the whole concept of utilitarianism along with Jeremy Bentham. So utilitarianism says that action is ready to promote happiness. Right? The greatest happiness and the greatest number should be the guiding principle of conduct. Okay? But there are concerns with this philosophy. Okay? So if you have a real powerful majority, but you have a neglected and very weak minority that can be taken advantage of, then you have problems where, the example I put is that adulterers were stoned to death in many countries because that was the rule. And so when you start thinking of examples of utilitarianism, you find weaknesses in that theory. I mean, you had majority of Mississippians in the 50s probably felt like black should sit in the back of the bus. That's where they belong. And so that would be a case against utilitarians. Viktor Frankl, he wrote a lot about happiness. He was an Austrian neurologist and psychiatrist in 1905 and 1997. He was a survivor of Auschwitz and other concentration camps. And he was a psychiatrist, and he had the opportunity to move to the United States before things got really bad in Nazi Germany. But he felt like he felt a duty to his parents, he felt a duty to those less fortunate than him. He was a Jewish psychiatrist. And he was in one of the concentration camps. He didn't spend too much time in Auschwitz, maybe that was passing through, but a couple of really interesting examples. There were two men there, two Jewish men, that both wanted to commit suicide. And one of them was a scientist who still had some unfinished papers that he wanted to complete writing. And he wanted to commit suicide, and Frankel was basically, you know, providing counseling in that extremely difficult setting. And he said, you have more of an obligation than just to your own happiness. You have important scientific papers that need to be published. You have a duty to a bigger realm than just you yourself. Another man wanting to commit suicide, he had a son that was in England. And Frankel said, your obligation is bigger than just your own happiness. Your obligation is to your son and to this meaning of your life. Your son gives you your life meaning. And those scientific papers give life meaning to that other man. And so I just thought the story was remarkable that you really, a little bit like Kant, you just take yourself out of your focus on your own happiness and you push those boundaries out to a purpose, a project bigger than yourself. He wrote Man's Search for Meaning. Has anybody read that book? It's a remarkable book, very inspiring. But Frankel said that happiness is not something we should pursue directly. We should focus on a purpose larger than ourselves. And take the person out of themselves and put yourself in a broader perspective, in a broader concept. And with this path, happiness and ethical behavior naturally ensue. And so he tied in happiness and ethical behavior, the fact that you're focusing, once again, kind of related back to Kant, you're focusing on something that's overall good for our society, and you're not focusing on David Drunk or David Alcock or Ken Sauter. You're focusing outward. And then, with that approach, it's just like some of the studies. I've read a lot of studies and books on happiness, and one of the real keys of happiness is volunteer work. When I go to the jail, I always feel so enlivened and refreshed and thankful that I'm in some way giving back to the community. And I mean, I could have been in jail if I had a horrible upbringing and extremely low IQ and a lot of disadvantages. And so I highly recommend Man's Search for Meaning. It's a remarkable. Okay, so now the whole idea of ethics and right behavior and all that, it brings us to Romology. Infuriates Molière's amazing play, but it infuriates me to be wrong when I know I'm right. So, does anybody relate to that? We like being right, don't we?
Yeah.
We love to be right. It's like up there with kissing and surfing and chocolate and all these, you know, Tchaikovsky's, you know, wonderful piano concertos, it's all these, you know, it's right up there, isn't it? We love being right, particularly when someone else is wrong, right?
Often wrong, but never in doubt.
Never in doubt, yes. So believe is an old English word to hold dear. We hold our beliefs dear and close to our heart, don't we? And this can get in the way of ethical behavior. This can get in the way of thinking that, well, maybe our approach is not completely right. Maybe our ethical behavior in this area is not completely right. We think at the time that we're being very ethical. But we're so invested in our beliefs. We fall in love with our beliefs. We're so invested in them that we cannot recognize them as anything but inviolable truth, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, can you think of any beliefs you have that are wrong?
Wouldn't believe
no, it was wrong. Once you recognize they're wrong, then that I was wrong. I was wrong, but you can never say, yeah, I have my beliefs are wrong. That doesn't make any sense, right? So, but by thinking that we're, this is falling apart. But by thinking that we're right on virtually everything, it provides stability. Our universe is knowable and stable and solid. We're walking on solid ground. We even think our memories are accurate. We think we are like flashbulb memories. Okay, so it's like, okay, whether it's the Kennedy assassination or older people like myself, or 9/11, or the Challenger in '86, or whatever, we have these flashbulb memories that we think are just dead on right. So I have a quote, and I may need to read this twice, but I want to see if someone can point out the problem with this. Okay? In December 1941, a 13-year-old boy named Ulrich Nesser was listening to the radio when he learned that the Japanese had just attacked Pearl Harbor. The experience made a huge impression on the child. For decades to come, 40 years, he would carry around the memory of a radio announcer interrupting the baseball game he had been listening to with the bullet and a duck bomb. A bullet and a duck bomb.
Okay.
What's the problem with that?
No baseball in December.
No baseball in December. Exactly. So perhaps what had happened is that maybe there was a trade announced, that baseball trade announced that day, or maybe some baseball player retired or something that linked those. But the thing is that our memories are a combination. Different parts of the brain have to put these memories together. Okay? So if you think about a memory that yours is going back?
I've never forgotten anything in my life.
I don't remember.
So there's different parts of the brain that recollect and recreate these memories. There's auditory, visual, and language, and all that. So it's not like there's a memory section of the brain that you can just grab and. It's like it has to get these composite parts. An example in the insurance business, risk management business, is if you have an accident and you run a stop sign, okay, you cause an accident. And the police said, or someone said, well, did you realize you were running that red light? Then you might start thinking that you ran a red light. You might correlate that. And so there's been a lot of examples of that where someone suggests something different that is now to running a red light, but it's running a stop sign. So our memories are very fallible. We think we have great memories, but often we don't. Okay? We also fight confirmation bias. So what is confirmation bias?
I already know that.
You already know that, but if you have new information coming in that differs from your belief of the world, whether it's religion, politics, sociology, psychology, whatever, if it differs from what you believe, you're going to probably discard it. You're going to be more interested and read more thoroughly about those things that confirm your bias. Okay. Once again, we want to believe that we're right. So someone that's very, very liberal will be less likely to watch Fox News. And that's it works both ways,
right,
no matter what political party you might have. But we believe that our model of reality, we believe our model of reality is reality itself. And these other people are wrong. We believe our model of reality is reality itself. So it's fun to be right, though, right? Is it hard to say, I told you so? When I was a young man, I would say, I tried very hard, I'm saving more, because people don't like to hear that, it's real, But that's an inescapable part of being alive. I was wrong, but who else made that error? Yeah. Well, but, so that means actually I wasn't wrong, right?
Yeah.
Mistakes were made, but not by me. Yeah. So any president, Republican or Democrat, they have made those comments. Mistakes were made, but not by me. Well, that's a tacit assumption. But if we have a certain belief, and we're certain it's right, then we think others are wrong. And they can be wrong for three reasons. First reason is that maybe they're ignorant. So I need to teach them the facts, right? I need to teach them what the facts are so they won't be ignorant, and then they'll accept the truth for a lot of holes, right? But if that doesn't work, then, okay, well, they're, I guess they're just a little slow. They're just, you know, they're not the sharpest, what's the phrase? They're not the sharpest tool in the shed. They're not the sharpest tool in the shed. Or maybe they're evil. I mean, that's the extreme example. But if someone tries to point out our errors, our moves are wrong, and they insult us, then what are we going to do? We're going to adhere to that position even more strongly, right? They can be right. They can be right about us. But, you know, we're going to like, oh, I'm going to hold on my position even tighter now. But it is fun to be right. And when you're right and someone else is wrong, and then you find out that they realize that they were wrong and you were right, then it's like right squared, you know? It's like right multiplied to the third power, or the fifth power. It's like, I was right about being right. Yes! You know? Okay, so errors are like cockroaches. We grab them, we flush them down the toilet as soon as we possibly can, right? And we, you know, we don't think about them. There's the Lake Wobegon effect. So, okay, so who likes Garrison Stewart? Yeah, he's too. He's not anymore.
No,
he's not anymore.
He's gone.
So what is the phrase? Lake Wobegon, where all the women are strong, all the men are good-looking, and all the children are blood marriage. Right. So on this topic, a few years ago, the states would do studies as far as an educational system. And they sent all the studies into Washington, individual studies, and they had their own way of deciding what it was. And each of the states said their students were above average compared to national. So how could all 50 states be above the national standards, you know? It's impossible. So, like marriage, okay, now I've been married almost twice, so I have a lot of room to be talking about marital advice. But the idea is that when we think about our, who's doing the most housework, right? We know exactly how much time we spend cleaning that toilet and dusting and doing all those things, but our spouse is kind of a distraction. It's not really clear, because what we're doing is we're comparing introspectively, it's asymmetrical information. We're comparing what we've done to this representation that someone else done that told us about. And maybe we saw some of the work they did, but it's still an abstraction. So we're comparing asymmetrical information. And then I love the study about the competent and incompetent people. So they've done some studies on this, and the competent people often recognize that in many areas they're not that competent. Okay? Whereas the incompetent people think that they're extremely competent on everything. So that's kind of like, okay, well, they're so incompetent that they can't even judge whether they're competent. So that's a little bit scary. So I mean, having a little bit of humility, you know, it's a good thing. Okay, so blind spots in Albert Speer. This is a fascinating case. Has anybody ever read Spandau Journals? It's a remarkable, remarkable book. It's like 400 pages, and I read it, and I was just transfixed with the whole thing. He was a close friend of Hitler and Hitler's personal architect.
What was that title?
Spandau Diaries. S-P-A-N-D-A-U. Spandau Journals, Spandau Diary. It's a remarkable book. He was the highest ranking Nazi official to ever express remorse for his actions. And he claimed that what he did was entirely unethical.
Wow.
He candidly addressed his failure to look for evidence of what was happening around him. Quote, I did not query a friend who told me not to visit Auschwitz. I did not query Himmler. I did not query Hitler, he wrote. I did not speak with personal friends. I did not investigate, for I did not want to know what was happening there. I did not investigate for fear of discovering something which might have made me turn away from my course. I had closed my eyes.
Oops.
I did not query, I did not question, I did not speak, I did not investigate, I shut my mouth, I closed my eyes. So this is an example of ethical blind spot or ethical thinking. So what the ethical thinking is, when we're thinking about some event in the future, okay, we have the word should applies. This is what one should do in this ethical situation. Or when we're looking back at something that happened in the past, and say, well, this is what one should do. Okay. But what happens is that if you're in a corporation and they have unrealistic goals and agendas, and now you're in a I want situation, you transform from I should to an I want situation. And so now it's like, okay, I've got to get that raise. I've got to feed my kids. I want, you know, this may seem, you know, may seem a little bit dicey. But the ethical blind spots and ethical aiming can happen even to the best of us. Okay? Particularly, just think about an example where you have all sorts of unrealistic goals for your employees, extremely unrealistic. Then the quality might suffer, and you don't do as good of a quality job as you know you can do. Well, that can be an example of unethical behavior. Just think about an airline mechanic or something like that. But ethical fading is basically these things where you're in the momentary decision making, then the I want takes over. I should starts to fade a little bit into the background. But then if we look back, we would say our ethical behavior was right. So it's like that cockroach I mentioned a minute ago, we better try and stomp it and throw it down the toilet. Henry Lee Lucas. Does anybody remember Henry Lee Lucas?
Yeah.
Okay, so what was the story about Henry Lee Lucas?
He murdered.
The mass murderer who has very, very horrible childhood.
Yes, horrible childhood. Yeah.
Interesting.
What else about that story? Does anybody remember? At one point, he confessed to maybe 300 or 400 murders.
He didn't actually kill him.
No. And so, but we have these law enforcement people that were so desperate to solve these crimes. They committed all these different crimes. And the families were so desperate to get solace and get closure. And so and the sheriff wanted to get reelected, you know? And so you had people, law enforcement from all over the country coming in here, and they gave Henry Lee Lucas as many cigarettes as he wanted. They gave him all the strawberry milkshakes that he wanted. They let him walk around the jail without any handcuffs. And they had to ask him leading questions. They had to give him some leading information for him to remember. And he never felt so special his whole life. He felt like, wow, I'm a superstar, you know. But that was a classic example of ethical faking. Because, I mean, to say that all these law enforcement, there's a task force of a dozen people. To say that they're all unethical, I think that's too simplistic. But they were ensconced in and fell into this ethical fading situation where they were so desperate to bring solace to the loved ones. And they want to get reelected and all these things. But what was crazy about it, here's some background on matricide in 1968. It did appear that he did kill his mother. 1983 arrest, but he said he committed up to 300 murders, and they cleared 213 previous unsolved murders. 213. But they found out as time went by that he made all these false confessions. Okay, so for an example, he confessed to a murder in Florida, but then the next day he confessed to like a murder in North Dakota. It's like, he liked to drive, but there was no physical way he could do that, okay? Or he, every once in a while, he'd get an odd job, and there were some receipts, you know, a payroll check or something like that, that showed that he worked certain days, you know, I think he was in Texas, he lived there for a while, but that there was a murder in California. So it was impossible. He confessed to a murder of a woman in Wisconsin. And then later on, it brought solace to the family. But later on, the woman's body, he said he cut her up with a knife. But later on, her body was found at the bottom of a lake, feeding God. So that's a really horrendous example of ethical fading. That we so want to achieve these things. We so want to catch the killer. And yet all these other killers, they were being undetected. And then DNA, that was really what opened it up. But the Dallas Times Herald, they did an exhaustive analysis, and they pointed out all these murders. And it's like, it would be physically impossible for him to go to all these different places. And so it really, and to talk about being wrong, you know. And then instead of bringing solace to the families, it brought even more heartache because it turned out he wasn't the killer. Okay, so this is one of my favorite stories. This man was had a sixth grade education. He grew up very, very poor. His father was a member of the Ku Klux Klan. He grew up in Alabama, I think. Very, extremely poor. And he worked in he's a janitor, worked in a gas station and all that. He was actually pretty bright. He didn't have an education, but he was bright. You know, a lot of people without education are pretty bright. And he had some leadership skills as well, but he was still very, very poor. Mm-hmm. But he was the grand poopah of the Ku Klux Klan. Sounds like he's North Carolina. Yeah, North Carolina. And so then Brown Board of Education was 54, I think. But by 1970, the North Carolina schools were still segregated. Okay. And so there was a lot of money that came in North Carolina. It's like, we've got to remedy this, more borders and all that. So they asked him to be on a task force with this woman, Ann Atwater. Now, Ann was sort of in the same plight as CPLs. And CPLs would say, I was 100% certain that the Ku Klux Klan, their role was dead on. That overall good of society meant keeping blacks down. Okay, so in a way, he would say, I have a duty to our overall society, like Kant might say, I have a duty to act. Okay, for the preservation of our society, to help our society. So this woman, she was also very uneducated, she was also very poor, but she was bright, she had leadership capabilities as well. And so they were sort of counterpoints, and so they decided, some of the civic leaders said, we need to appoint these two people to chair this task force. And he said, I'm not dealing with her, and she's not dealing with him, and he carried a shotgun in his car, and he made racist comments to her, and she's like, I'm going to get this Bible, and I'm knocking the hell out of your head with this Bible. She carried a white Bible everywhere. But they agreed, finally, to do it. Now, all of his Ku Klux Klan friends said, we disown you. He got even death threats. You know, he turned to the bottle and all that. Well, what was amazing is that one night after they had a long conference trying to work out compromises and all that, they started talking about their childhood. They started talking about their children, and their children went to the same schools. And they talked about the horrendous poverty that they faced, and the stigmatization of their children. And before they know it, CPL started crying and crying and crying, and he realized, I have more in common with Ann Atwater than I do with all these rich white people or these middle-income white people. And so it was like an amazing revelation. Stead Strobel, in his book, Working, he talked about this case, where at the end of that evening, he went and turned his keys into the KKK and said, I'm out, and he started getting death threats and all that. But he was strong enough to recognize that all this ethical beliefs that he had, they were wrong. And it's rare. It's really, really rare. And then when he died, she gave the eulogy at his funeral. I have a couple of quotes here on Ellis. He said, and this was what abject poverty can do to one. I'll never forget the night when they put the white robe on me and the hood, and I was led down the hall and knelt before the illuminated cross. It was thrilling, nobody felt like something. But then, you know, he started talking to Atwater and all that, and he felt this powerful jolt of recognition. He saw his life and his poverty and the poverty of his children. He saw that, her poverty, he saw that in himself. He said, I began to see, here we are, two people from the far ends of the fence, having identical problems, except her being black and me being white. From that moment on, I tell you, that gal and I worked together good. I began to love the girl good. So, Ethics and Property Incorporated, I need to speed this up a little bit for questions, but, you know, I was reading a book about Poverty Incorporated and about how giving stuff, you know, for Haiti's earthquake, you know, mass starvation in Africa and all of that, that giving free stuff to these communities is good, right? But what Socrates would say is that dig really, really deep when you think about this. Mm-hmm. Because you give free stuff to people, then basically it's a new form of paternalism.
That's right.
Right? We give them all this free stuff, then basically the message we're saying to them, even though we think it's ethical, the message we're sending them is that you're not even good enough to be able to buy your own shoes. We have to give the shoes to you. Mm-hmm. What it also did is it put a lot of the cobblers up, Haiti and the Congo, they would send them free shoes and even solar panels. We'd send them free solar panels. They put the solar panel companies out of business. Okay, there were some solar panel, a couple of solar panel companies in the Congo. Put them out of business. We gave them all these free t-shirts, all this free stuff. We put the local weavers and the cotton industry in Kenya out of business. So we have to think about the unintended consequences of these actions. And so I think, well, that's, you know, that's good to give stuff to the poor people. It's a good thing, you know? Not necessarily. And so that's another example of like digging really deep and thinking about the consequences of our action. I mean, we have ethical decisions or we have particular political or religious beliefs or whatever it might be. It's like, think about the consequences. And who might be hurt and given to the consequences as well. So ethical business dilemmas, pressure for management, conflicting values between two or more people in an organization. You're negotiating and you've got to get that deal. You've got a lot of pressure. You might fudge a little bit on what you can promise and what you can't promise. So now, once again, you're back in the ethical phase, right? Because you want to get that deal. And it's not like you're an unethical person, but ethics can, that particular, in that critical moment, decision making, ethics can fade. We have to be on guard for that. Unrealistic expectations of employees. I knew a guy who was an adjuster, and he said, "Well, we had to have 40 open claims, okay? But it was too much. We couldn't do it. We were working 60 hours a week, and these are really complex claims." And so, and if you close the claim, then they would give you another one. And so what they would do is that they would make up some minor excuse to delay closing the claim. They'd say, "Oh, I need this piece of unimportant information." They would do these steps to ask for unimportant information so they didn't have to close the claim, so they wouldn't get more work. So basically, there's ethical failing, but yet, I mean, it's unethical to go home and see your family, right? It's a right to have to be working 65 hours a week. So that's one thing that I've talked to groups before, is that you need to have realistic expectations of your employees, because if you don't, then you're more prone to ethical failure. So it occurs when the ethical aspects of a decision slowly become obscured, often also called ethical degradation. It's a fascinating topic. You can Google it. We focus on some other goals, but the should self dominates during the prediction and recollection phase. But the want self dominates during the critical action phase. Mm-hmm. So it just becomes. And based on the research I've done, nearly everybody can
fall prejudice. We tend to see what we're looking for, self-deception. We are looking for loopholes and shelters. And we go back to, you know, what Kant was saying, you can't make an exception for yourself because if the whole system breaks down, you know, the universality and the categorical imperative. Because you make an exception for yourself, then that means everybody's going to make an exception for themselves. And then the whole system falls on its face. So we're all familiar with the Enron scandal. Enron, they had, with Arthur Anderson, they had extremely lucrative consulting fees. Okay? So they were providing consulting for Enron, but they also were in charge of the audit. Okay? And they recognized that Enron was doing some really efficient things in their audit, but they didn't want to risk polarizing Enron. They basically kind of went along with what Enron was saying because they did not want to lose that lucrative consulting business. Okay? And so that was another prime example of ethical failure where the whole system broke apart and Arthur Anderson went out of business, Enron of course went out of business. You have companies that focus only on the share price. Okay? They don't focus on the other stakeholders. That's what enterprise risk management is about. You have to remember all the stakeholders. You have to remember that the environment for a factory, the environment, the community is a stakeholder. Right? The employees are stakeholders. Shareholders are stakeholders. Suppliers are stakeholders. Right? Customers are stakeholders. And so the beauty of enterprise risk management is you have to just try and incorporate corporate governance. Is you have to try and balance all these different stakeholders. Look at the Exxon Valdez and all the shortcuts and the BP, British Petroleum, Horizon, Deepwater Horizon. They cut corners, you know, because they were getting so much pressure. You got to get that stock price up, you know, Mr. CEO. So that's an example, again, of ethical baiting. Some other insurance, we talked about the adjusters. So the takeaways is, with ethics training, have ethics training in companies, and have someone that's a devil's advocate. Okay. So philosophers are all about being devil's advocate, right? We pride ourselves on whether we have philosophy as a vocation or an avocation. We pride ourselves on trying to be devil's advocate in a nice way. We try and point out weaknesses. Realistic expectations of employees, grasp the complexity of ethical decisions, realize that ethical baiting is real and it happens every day. Question and dig deeper when in doubt. Remember Socrates, the father of philosophy. Look at the big picture. Think about the consequences of our action. Don't, once again, donating, giving all this free stuff to someone, you know, it's not always a good thing. In many cases, it's a bad thing. If you have a child, we think that we're doing good to help a child that's irresponsible with money. But it gets more complicated. There's unintended consequences, and that can backfire as well. And remember the relationship between ethics, happiness, and the good life. So Albert Schweitzer, amazing writer, theologian, humanitarian philosopher, said ethics is the activity of man directed to secure the inner perfection of his own personality. That sounds a lot like Aristotle. Socrates would argue that the ensuing result is happiness, a state which fulfills a man's search for meaning. Thank you very much.
How's that for a picture?
All right.
If I may, I'm going to take up here. In Aristotle, he used the word eudaimonian, or
eudaimonian, yeah,
which we translate as happiness, but it's really more translated as a sense of well-being,
contentment. Yeah.
Yes, right. And that it's an end in itself. Like, for example, money is not an end in itself, it's what it can get, what it. And after you've had, you know, bought two or three houses, does that make you any more happy? You're not owning a sense of well-being. But anyway, questions?
On your use of eudaimonia, the first place I ever heard eudaimonia, ironically, was when Louis Malthus used it. And he was making fun of Ayn Rand and said, oh, I see. Some guy in the audience and asked the question, says, well, capitalism is merely a means rather than a philosophy. Let's believe in some cuckoo land Ayn Rand sense. We've had a sort of eudaimonia pervading through the society. But it does seem like, in some of what you said, if you have the right regulatory mechanisms, pursuit of self-interest can be, if you have, for example, Anderson regulating.
Yeah.
And if you had later on S&P doing their job
right
over the banks and said, oh yeah, you're good. Yeah. So you need that, and you also need, of course, some regulation by law of negative externalities for people like BP, you know, barfing oil all over the beaches, things like that.
Right.
So, but if you had those, usually you do have some kind of sense that if you pursue your unhappiness, then it's set up so that you won't be hurting others. The problem is when you get to other things, like, let's go back a little bit in history to Genghis Khan.
Question?
Yeah, my question is, like, with Genghis Khan, his sense of happiness...
He's a real father of society.
Huh?
What? He's a real father of society.
Well, that's the problem. I mean, he said literally, save the prettiest ones for me, and they've now proven that was what was done, that he was the father of Central Asia. And I mean, you need some sense that you don't just care about your own self-interest. That you're willing to stand up to a Genghis Khan and say, we're going to stop this. But the problem is, who bells the cat? You're one weak soldier, everybody else?
Right.
Well, let's go along to get along.
So that, I mean, that gets back to, you know, the middle way in Buddhism, and it gets back into, you know, the meme that, a lot of the meme that, Aristotle talking about is that you need to have that balance. So like, when you brought that up, reminded me of Alan Greenspan after the 2008 financial crisis. He believed in laissez-faire all the way, baby. All the way, no regulation, because the banking industry self-regulates. And he said, I was wrong.
Yeah.
He said, I was dead wrong on that. But it's like, you have to have some beliefs to like give yourself a foundation. And that was a belief he had. And so it was really telling that he had admitted to Congress and the whole country, yeah, I missed the vote on that one.
Yeah.
Because there's got to be... So then you get into the whole issue, though, is if you have too much regulation, then, you know, that can really stifle businesses and all that. So finding that balance, that's the challenge. Yeah, good point. So,
hi, Rob. I really like... So, Rob, I really liked how you started out talking about different definitions of happiness. One of the things you didn't mention was the environment in which these people lived.
Right.
And right, what influence did that environment have on the way they looked at happiness?
Yeah. Oh, I mean, you look at the examples of some of the people I brought up, their environments were so horrendous.
Oh, wow.
You know,
especially in Kant, right? Living in Russia during a time living in Russia pre-revolutionary time. I mean, the world couldn't get more bleak or rich anymore, as opposed to Socrates or Aristotle, who were that dumb and happy, right? I mean, they had servants all over the place.
Well, and then you could also simply make the argument that if you are just trying to pay the next bill, you know. You don't have much of an education, you're trying to pay the next bill, you can't really, okay, I'm going to think I'm going to need Aristotle, you know, Aristotle's view on happiness, you know, I mean, you've got to focus on paying the bills, and so obviously it does have a profound impact, but there's some people that can overcome that real difficult upbringing. Another question?
I'll go ahead and ask one. It always troubled me about the categorical imperative because it seems to me you could always write your maxim to fit your situation. For example, you say it's wrong to steal, but if you say, oh, my maxim is it's right to steal to get a piece of bread for my family,
yeah, exactly.
then if that's applied universally, that's okay. But if you say the maxim is it's wrong, you know, it's right to steal, then that's... So how do you write the maxim?
Well, Kant would say that it's just wrong, because then everyone is going to steal that piece of bread. Mm-hmm. So Kant, during his lifetime, he was challenged on this point by another philosopher, I forgot who his name was, that said, okay, so you've got a murderer that wants to know where his victim is, and they ask you, and you know where that victim is, and you know they're going to go murder that victim. Kant would say, well, the best thing to do is not answer the question. But then the worst thing to do is to lie. Because then the whole categorical imperative, the whole universality breaks down. And a lot of philosophers challenge Kant on that. Mm-hmm. So like basically no exceptions. Well, so like your wife says, does this dress make me, you know, grumpy? Well, of course not, dear, but maybe it does make you look grumpy, you know? It's like, well, Kant would be, maybe Kant, you know, had as much love in the marriage part as I do. Maybe, you know, it's just, you know, it makes you look grumpy. But he basically said there's no exceptions. But what's interesting about Kant is that is going to beg the argument that there is an absolute truth about them. Okay, so when we're talking about being wrong, then that presupposes that there's some type of rightness or there's some type of truth there. And so that argument has been begun with philosophers for forever. And so, I mean, I would argue that there are some absolutes. I mean, gravity is pretty much, there is gravity, right? We see that, experience that all the time, you know? And we all know that, you know, child prostitution is a horrendous wrong. Or slavery is a horrendous wrong. But we didn't all believe that 200 years ago or 300 years ago. There's weaknesses in the categorical imperative, and one of them would be, you know, do we really know what our moral duty act is?
Questions?
I'm curious if there's any information or any precedence to being overwhelmed with options in terms of trying to find the maximum, in terms of trying to find any of those relevant conversations. In this New World Order, those people back then weren't inundated with constant opposition to their own belief systems or to their own identity or to their own rights.
They mostly were living homogeneous villages.
So do they have any kind of insight into, well, let's pretend we get to this world where that's a possibility, and that now we are in a reverse way, trying to constantly, on the daily almost, question our belief systems or our maxims or our place in society and the reasons why we choose to do or not to do.
So I'm not sure I understand.
So was there any insight that they expected a society to evolve to that point where the individuals would have to then face a different kind of process where we're forced to arbitrate with so much information and so many different ideologies and beliefs
that make it more difficult?
Did they have any kind of insight into how they might have seen that society deal with that? Or process that information?
Well, I haven't read anything particularly on that point. I do know that a lot of philosophers have said that scientists said that we believe that we are going to be able to eliminate error in the future, which is really kind of ridiculous, right? That's our human nature as far as believing in that. But on the positive side of that is that as you have a more of a heterogeneous society, more of a complex society, you're exposed to different things. And the hope is that you're going to recognize that, you know, particularly if you're more well-educated, you're going to recognize that maybe your belief systems have some flaws in them because you're exposed to different viewpoints. But we tend to like to associate with people that we have a lot in common. You know, we find support, and we tend to like people that, you know, we have a lot in common with, versus someone that we don't have a lot in common with, or have totally different pieces. So that makes it tougher and all that. But that's a really good question. I have to ponder that one some more. But we are more and more in a heterogeneous society, and so I think it's incumbent upon us to remember that it may not be right on these things. And I think it makes us better human beings.
Mm-hmm.
I think it makes us more tolerant human beings. It makes us more compassionate human beings. And that certainty, rigid certainty, is anti-creative, anti-empathetic, anti-sympathetic, and it makes you less approachable.
Because I was curious, how does your presentation go over in jails?
Well, at the jails, my talk is a little bit different. It's the 15 keys to happiness. And I talk about I'm very open with them about my dealings with suicide ideation and the depression that I went through and the medications. And so basically my focus is, you know, if I could overcome depression, you can too. So one of my little goals in life is to try and destigmatize depression. And I talk real openly about it. And I'm on medication now, and I'm doing really well, I'm pretty happy. But I'm trying to destigmatize depression. But I basically really have to, it's got to be really simple, and it's really interactive. I used to work with 16-year-old boys, and they don't talk. You can't get a word out of those guys, you know. But when you talk to women just open up, and they talk, and talk, and talk, and talk, and I can't really get a word in edgewise. But I talk about the different keys to happiness, it's very, very rewarding. And some of these women are there's a few of them that they're pretty bright. I brought up neuroplasticity of the brain, you know, that you can change your brain. You know, you start reading, you know, more deep books, you start studying, go back to school, get your GED, go to community college. And a couple of them knew neuroplasticity, and I went back the next week and said, yeah, we used that word neuroplasticity with our inmates, you know. I got a kick out of that. You have to really make it simple. You have to make it more simple and straightforward. But, you know, surprisingly, a lot of them are pretty bright. And a lot of them are really, I asked, you know, what are you grateful for? And there was the one woman I remember so vividly. She was like 18, and she could have been on boat, man. She was really beautiful. And she said, "I'm grateful because here I am now in jail with my sisters. And a year ago, I was in with my boyfriend shooting up heroin in, you know, a horrible motel somewhere." And you know, that really struck with me. So it's like that's an example. At least for me, I'm trying to find a purpose bigger than myself, and so. Susan and I were talking about that earlier. It's like, really, volunteer work, it can be so rewarding. We all have different skills, different interests.
Yeah. Could you put up that first slide of people, was it Plato, was it?
Socrates was the first one.
Socrates? Yeah, whichever one it was. Can that really be a man of that age?
Yeah, baby.
Well, he had to break the hemlock. He had to break the hemlock there, so we're not completely sure how if that's a proper word or not. But he had to break the hemlock because he was corrupting the youth of Athens. Right? Yeah. And that was a democracy, and the juries back then were like 200 men. 200 free men. But isn't that Raphael's painting?
I don't know who did
it. I think it's Raphael's.
No, that's Jean David.
Is it?
Jean David.
Okay, I'll take your word for it.
I have one other quick little point. The way back in those years, the Vikings lived in a society where the women ruled the villages. They were the queens.
Because the men were gone, right?
Yes, and they obviously made a very unique system to attain happiness. They built longboats and got the hell out of there.
Sounds good.
We have time for one more. This is a quick question. What did
Kant and some of the other philosophers you mentioned based the duty on. It seems like
based what on?
The duty. Basically, really there was a duty
right.
from the individual to society. And I was just wondering, is that something that's like reverse engineering, but if we have a duty, then we get the best result of it. See some external authority or some existing truth.
Well, I think it was a twist.
John, can you repeat that? I didn't.
Yeah.
Can you repeat the question?
Yes. What was the basis of the duty that Kant presupposed and concluded ran from the individual owed to society?
Well, that's a good question. I've not read Kant himself. I've read a lot of over the years, different books and articles about Kant. But he really felt that there were these universal laws that applied to the betterment of society, the goodness of society. And I believe that he was also a theist, and nearly all the philosophers were theists at that time. And so that goodness of society perhaps was provided by God because of this theistic voice. So maybe that's the termination of that.
Thank you, Rob.
Thank you.